Want to wish everybody modim simcha. Welcome here. We'll be having, of course, this is our first of six classes this week during Chalamoid. Our two classes tomorrow, two on Thursday, Friday morning. So please do join us. Chalamoid is time for extra learning. If people don't work, I don't know that people don't work, but in theory, so time for extra learning. Anyway, it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Mark. We missed him last week, of course, Yom Kippur. Then that was a good reason not to have a class, Yom Kippur evening. Motzei Yom Kippur. Okay, let's get back to Rav Soloveitchik. Bakasha, Dr. Mark.
Yeah, as I recall, is Yerushalmi, it says, one of the Amoraim, that the whole reason not to work is so people can learn. And if they're not learning, no reason not
that, the there's no reason not to learn on Chol HaMoed. I don't know where that where I work, okay. Where I work, we teach, we have school, Chol HaMoed, chat, out of this. Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I have so a lot of things. I'll go get to maybe 15 minutes worth, and then when we're done, we'll continue for Soloveitchik, and we'll get back in a future class. First thing I want to say, correction. I said that I mentioned that after Chief Rabbi Hertz died, they quoted someone's memoir, Bernard Homa. Actually, he has descendants who live in New Jersey, went to Kushner. The name is Homa. But that he wrote that Rav Soloveitchik was one of the people they considered, but because of his use of the fork and knife, they nixed him. And I said I found it hard to believe that they would be interested in Rav Soloveitchik at that time. He wasn't as well known. But thank you, Rabbi Abraham Lieberman, who called my attention to this book. Hats in the Ring, Choosing Britain's Chief Rabbis from Adler to Sachs. And lo and behold, Rav Soloveitchik was one of the people that they considered, although I don't know what it means, considered, because the report they have is not so good. They thought he was a bit of an extremist, and the way he treated the non-Orthodox and others. So I don't know how seriously he was considered, but he was one of the people, and they even wrote a letter to someone in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a judge, to get a report on him. So at least one person suggested him. So for more details, you can check out this book. Thank you, Rabbi Lieberman. I wanted to clarify last week about doctors, Kohanim who are doctors, because I mentioned Rav Gorin. So, and we spoke about, maybe we left it with the impression that a Kohen can't be a doctor, which I think is, can't go to medical school, I should say, which I think is maybe the standard view, but it's not unanimous. Here's a work, Toras HaRefuah, Torat HaRefuah by Rav Gorin. And on pages 242 and on, he has two pieces here about can a Kohen learn anatomy, go to medical school. The first one is was sent to Larry Waxman, if anyone knows him, from Yeshiva University, and Joel Wawelski. And it's a longer tshuva. And Rav Gorin, his maskana is that, yes, a Kohen can go to medical school. So how can a Kohen go to medical school? Well, we know that the standard view is that non-Jews are not matame, so therefore they could be in a room when there's dead bodies there. But what about the fact that even a non-Jew, Cohen is not allowed to touch a non-Jew whose corpse? Well, Rav Gorin says that that is the standard view. However, the Uraim, Rav Elezer of Metz, permits it. And Rav Gorin says, "Kedai hu ba'al ha'yareim v'smocho v'shas ha'tchak." He says that this is such an important profession, refuah, being a doctor, study of medicine, that if a Kohen really wants to do it, he says that you can rely on the Sefer Yareim, halacha l'maisa. So there you have, if you want to rely on Rav Gorin, that's up to you, I guess. But Rav Gorin says that. Now, what about in a Jewish hospital, what about for Jews? Let's say you're in Israel. That's more tricky. And Rav Gorin comes up with a heter, which also he says would help for Kohanim going into hospitals. And this is what I mentioned last week. And you can read more, Rabbi David Shabtai. There's a number of people in English, in Hebrew, write about it. But Rabbi David Shabtai has a piece in English on his website, Medical Halacha. And I'm not such an expert in Tuman Tara, but there's different levels of Tuman Tara, and if you have a piece of metal, which is tame from touching the dead body, a kohen is allowed to touch that, and it doesn't add. There's no prohibition. So Rav Gorin suggested you have a piece of metal that's has this tumah, and the kohen who has it with him, therefore he can also go into a hospital, and it doesn't add more tumah. Rabbi Shabtai speaks about why the other rabbani rejected this. They didn't see it as a technical issue of just tumah, but the whole idea of being close to a mace. In fact, Rav Schechter in Nefesh HaRav quotes the Rav. I think he quotes him in two separate places as completely rejecting Rav Gorin's approach. But Rav Gorin also came up with a heter in Israel. But the one and that is it's a little more iffy. But he's absolutely sure of himself when it comes to Chutz La'aretz. So. I was asked by more than one person, because we spoke about the Rav and teaching of girls, who was the first one to teach Torah Shebaal Peh to young women? Was it the Rav? And look, I don't know. If anyone knows the first one in an organized fashion, they didn't do it in Germany. They did teach Shulchan Aruch, their kids are Shulchan Aruch, but they did not teach, as far as I know, Mishnah or Gemara. I don't know who the first one is. However, Bernard Drachman, in his autobiography, The Unfailing Light, on pages 367 to 368, he's talking about 1918, something which continued for 7 or 8 years. He talks about how he had a class of girls and he taught them Mishnah in the original Hebrew. So that takes us to the early 20th century. Was this the first organized class of Torah Shabbat Peh for girls? I don't know, but if anyone can find an earlier one, please let me know and I will report it. Okay, in terms of the Rav, the two positions that he w wanted to wanted both president of YU and also obviously Rosh Yeshiva after his father passed away. You can get all the details in Zev Elif's article in. Forget where the article is, appears here. Oh, in American Jewish Archives, called Freedom and Responsibility, The First Orthodox College Journalists and Early Yeshiva College Politics. So basically, it's a study of the young men running the commentator and what was pushing them. Now, some of these young men later became well-known rabbis and things like that. And that's where he deals with everything I mentioned, including Leonard Rosenfeld, who would become the son-in-law of Rabbi Jung. And apparently, at least the story was, the people in the 50s testified to this, that he was the one responsible. The commentator came out with a very anti-Rav Soloveitchik report, an editorial. And a lot of this had to do with the fact that Agudas HaRabbanim was trying to push the Rav. Agudas HaRabbanim, after Revel dies, they write to the board of directors, say, we're going to be in charge now. And the board was like, what do you mean? You're going to be in charge. We're in charge. And the same thing, they said that after Rav Moshe died, they said the Rav has to take his place. And the students were not so happy with it. And one of the students who was opposed to the Rav, his name was Moses Feuerstein. It's a great irony because later the Feuerstein family became big backers of the Rav, and Mo Feuerstein became very close to the Rav. But he was on the side of the students who were opposed to the Rav, and they thought that they didn't want the Rav to be given this position. So you can read all about it. Okay, 5 more minutes. I listened to the class last week and the class from 2 weeks ago, and one of you said, well, what about if you non-Jewish law? Maybe it's better than Jewish law in certain areas. And I gave what I think is a good defense of Jewish law. I just want to call your attention to something about Choshen Mishpat we're talking about. That the rabbis have the authority if they want to make takanot, if they want to change things, if things are not working properly. It's not just in the days of Hillel you can make takanot; they can continue to make takanot. But it's more than that. We have something called pshara, compromise. I want to read you what Rav Kook says about the role of compromise. You can go before a Beis Din and you can give authority to the Beis Din to make a pshara. And if you do that, Rav Kook says as follows. This is an Orach Mishpat, his Tshuvos, page 196 to 197. He says, That is, if there's another way to solve a problem, she'im yiru, that is the based in she'im yiru shahadin hu neged hayosher hasichli l'fim atzav anyan. If the based in sees that if you decide according to the halacha, it'll go against the yosher hasichli. That is what I think I translate yosher hasichli. What people's mind appears to be incorrect, unfair. Sha'az kevan sheish b'yadam asos pshara. Since the Dayanim have the right, have the authority to do pshara, yesh mitzvah d'tzinek tzinek tirdof bein l'din bein l'pshara. That is based in, if they see that the law is going to lead to an inequitable situation. There are sometimes, the lawyers who are with us can tell us, sometimes the law will come to one conclusion, but you know it's not correct. That is, you know it's not right. But that's the law. So it's not equitable. So based in can move in and make a pshara, which is equity. So here you have Rav Kook stating that sometimes the law is not in line with the Yosher HaSichli, with what really we know is correct. He's not the first one. I found in the Divrei Malkiel, Malkiel seat Tenenbaum of Lomja. I made a mistake a couple semesters ago. I said that Rav Herzog is a relative of his. It's not true. Rav Shaul Lieberman is a great nephew or something of him. He says as follows, that what is pshara? He says to make pshara is to do alpi yosher. Kigon alpi din magiyan lo akesef av alpi yosher in roi shekhenu. That the different Malkiel says that you can have a situation where the law is that the person should take the money, but according to yosher, according to morality, he shouldn't take it. Like, let's say you know that this guy is lying, but you can't prove it because you don't have the witnesses have been disqualified, but you know as best as you could know. According to the law, he's entitled, but it's not Yosher. And the Rav, since we're dealing with the Rav, let me mention the Rav. Rav Shechter quotes the Rav in Nefesh HaRav, pages 267 and on, where the Rav explains what is Yosher. I mean, what is a pshara? He says it's psak of lifnim esharas hadin hamiyusad al pi yosher, which is based on yosher, the right thing. And he says that the halacha doesn't say in this case to divide the money into two, but the pshara says to libo al pi regesh yosher. He says that lifamim yepsak b'pshara lehefech b'me'achuz me'pesak il pasku afi adin. He says that sometimes pshara yosher will be the exact opposite of what it would be if you decided according to halacha. So here we have examples where the law, the Rambam says that sometimes law, all legal systems are this way. That sometimes someone will get the short end of the stick. But that's just, you can't really avoid it. That's the law deals with generalities. So one way to solve this is through Yosher, through Beistin, through Pshara, things like that. And you could have a halacha that comes out wrong and goes and immoral in its ruling, but that's the law. So sometimes the king can provide equity, the Rabbanim can, and Beistin can. And I just think it's striking that you have the Lashon here of contrasting what the Din is versus Yosher. Sometimes Din can be opposed to Yosher. It strikes you as strange, as controversial? That's why I'm not saying it. I'm quoting the Gnol Yisrael saying it. And okay, it's time now to go to the Rav. I'll get back next time. Thank you, Yehuda, sending me the letter in the Journal of Halakha and Talmud Society about the kashrus of home establishments. I'll get to that next class. More interesting stuff, including history, which I didn't know about. So we'll get to that next class. But let's pick up where we were. We're entering a new section now in the letters. But before we get to that, there was one final thing I needed to tell you. Because the Rav, if you recall, last class was talking about the curriculum and everything we need to train rabbis. And one of the things he mentions is that on page 104, he says this: the rabbi now, he's not just a Talmud Chacham. He also, in fact, the Rav wouldn't say it, but I'll say it. For our purposes, being a Talmid Chacham is like the least of the things the rabbi needs to know. Let's be honest. I know rabbis would stone me maybe if I said it, but it's the truth. When's the last time a shul chose a rabbi because they thought he was the better, biggest Talmid Chacham? They choose a rabbi because they like his personality, because they like his sermons, because they like his personality. They think he'd be good. Or they choose a rabbi because he was in 10 years in Kollel and he knows more than the others. That's not really relevant to a community. But the Rav doesn't say that. All he says is that we need to add these extra things. But in speaking about how the rabbi needs to be broadened, he says that the synagogue is now the focus of communal life. And he says the rabbi is the guide and counselor in matters pertaining to ritual. He says, quote, I know of many incidents in which the rabbi forfeited his exalted position because of his ignorance of the foundations of prayer. And right, he's speaking about how you have to know basic things about prayer. And but I think it's more than that, because in the Rav's own family, this happened. I don't know how many of you know the story. It's a famous story, but the Rav tells it in the Rav Thinking Aloud as well, right at the beginning. Pages 1 and 2. Does anyone know why the Beis HaLevi, his first marriage ended in divorce? This is the way the Rav tells the story, that that the father-in-law of the Beis HaLevi asked him when he had just become Rav. Actually, no, I don't know if he was Rav yet. He asked him if he should say Avarachamim or not, or Tzidkas Chasedek, one of these days where it's hard to know, do you say it or you don't say it? And the Beis HaLevi said that he didn't know, we have to look up in the Luach. And his father-in-law, the first father-in-law, was very annoyed. Since he didn't know the answer, he said, look up in the Luach. He forced his daughter to divorce him. And this isn't just the Rav repeating this. It appears in the Encyclopedia Judaica, if you look at it. This is how they read it. While in Volozhin, yeah, this is before he's a Rav. While in Volozhin, he married into a wealthy family, but was shortly thereafter forced by his father-in-law to divorce his wife when he failed to give the correct order of the recitation of some minor prayers on a festival. So whatever the exact details are, we know that the father-in-law thought that the fact that the Beis HaLevi could give gondas on all the different sugyas, the fact that didn't matter. The fact that he didn't know whether you say it on this day or that day, that was enough for him to think he's an Am Haaretz and force him out. And the Rav actually explains that he goes on that they had a daughter at this time. And later she married someone. He gives the name, and their son, that is the Beis HaLevi's first wife, her second marriage, her son was one of the leading socialists in the Russian Empire. And Tono Amaritz, he says. So, and the Rav says, that's how I knew about this. I remembered it. The Rav says the encyclopedia has this story because Holzer says, yes, it's in the encyclopedia. So, it's a famous story, though. I heard it even before I saw this about the Beis HaLevi being forced to divorce. How old was the Beis HaLevi then? 16 years old or something? I don't know. Crazy story, but it's a true story. You have to say, okay, let's pick up now. In the volume of letters, beginning on page 109, it's a new section, which Helfgott calls it Orthodoxy, the Synagogue, and the American Jewish Community. A whole big section of this we're not going to do, dealing with mechitzas, because we already dealt with mechitzas. But the first letter is, I find it also quite interesting. It's a letter to Rabbi Theodore Adams, from 1953, who was president of the Rabbinical Council of America. He was a rabbi in Jersey City, and also for our people on the Upper West Side, Ohev Tzedek. He was the rabbi in Ohev Tzedek. Now, in 1953, they were putting together a new translation of the Tanakh. You have the JPS, and then they're putting together a new JPS. And that's very popular today, the JPS, the English. I think it's considered a very good translation. And they wanted, though, this to be very inclusive, unlike the first one. And therefore, they wanted to have Orthodox, conservative, and reform representatives on the committee. So they approached the RCA to suggest people. And Rabbi Adams asked the Rav, can we participate in this with reform and conservative to create a Tanakh? Well, suffice it to say, before I read you what the Rav says, that the Rav's answer is no. there was an Orthodox person who eventually was chosen, and here he is. Our people from England might know him, or Australia, or by Harry Friedman. He's one of the translators of Sansino, Talmud, and Midrash, and later the Encyclopedia Talmudis. He was one of the contributors of the, but other than him, as far as I know, there were no Orthodox people. He was, you know, living in Australia at that time. He's not going to be someone, I guess, who feels bound to the Rav. But the Rav was very, very opposed to it. He says, first of all, if the way they said, that why do they need a new translation? They had a translation in the late 19th, early 20th. I forget the exact year. What do they need a new translation for? And they said that there's new modern scientific studies that have come out. And, you know, basically we know more. I think that what they were referring to was that we know more in terms of languages, you know, Ugaritic. Now we know, so we can maybe explain words differently. The Rav took it in a completely other way. He thought that this they're going to use their influence of higher biblical criticism for their translation of the Tanakh. And he said, we can have nothing to do with that. I don't think that's what it means at all. I think it's just that in the mid-50s, they knew more of, you know, more about languages. They thought they gave a better translation. And they published, incidentally, you can pick it up at a used bookstore, notes. After they came out with the translation, they came out with notes explaining why they translated this way and not that way. It's very helpful. In fact, I think, if I'm not mistaken, is it JPS New? I don't know. In one of the Makos, they translate it differently than what we usually translate it as. I forget now. I forget now which one, but I think it's one of them. So what does he say? He says that the only way we could agree to be part of this, he says we could be part of it, is if the JPS, the Jewish Bible Society, would give the RCA the power to veto anything contrary to our tradition. Because the Rav said also that it needs to be in line with, you know, Torah Shabbat Peh. You're not translating it like Rashbam or Ibn Ezra. It has to be in line with Torah Shabbat Peh. Because he says, we are representatives of Torah Shabbat Peh. We can't give our name to such an undertaking unless we're involved with it. And that would never happen. The other thing that the Rav was asked about by Rabbi Adams is that there was a committee of Jews that wanted to have the tercentenary celebration. That is, when is it? Is it 1654? Is that the first Jews landing in America? I forget. So they wanted to do something in 15. Rabbi Kelman's nodding his head, so it's correct. So they wanted to do something, and they wanted to, you know, have it for everyone. So they asked the Rav, could we, namely the Orthodox community, join together with the non-Orthodox? You know, we'll do something in our show. They're just, but something to recognize, you know, 3 centuries of America. It's been a great it's been great for Jews in America. And there should be Hakara Satov. And they came up with all sorts of proposals, readings of Psalms, all sorts of things. And the Rav, as you can imagine, we're going to get to later today, if not today, next time, what he has to say about Yom Ha'atzmaut liturgy. But he says that traditional Judaism doesn't like, as he calls it, synthetic prayers and artificial services. He says, we have our own Psalms. We have our own, we don't, you know, we have our own prayers. We don't come up with special things. And he goes on to say that he said originally they wanted to have from September 54 to May 55, a time of religious observance and celebration. And the Rav says that this is ludicrous. You're going to go on for months and months of religious observance. He says that doesn't make any sense. Religious Jews don't do that. If you celebrate it for a short period of time, you don't go on for months and months and months. He also says we cannot sign, quote, a joint proclamation with other national rabbinic bodies. He says we can sign manifestos as citizens and as Jews, but not as rabbis. There's, quote, there's no common ground between us and the others. So therefore, you can't have the RCA sign a document calling on synagogues to do something together with the non-Orthodox. And he says, if, however, we do agree to do something, and the Rav thinks something should be done, he's a big patriot. We have to recognize this. He says it should be during the week of Hanukkah. because that's the time for rejoicing and thanksgiving. We don't create our own things. He says we don't arbitrarily choose a date not marked by the halacha. And he, the example that they wanted to give, you know, like a special date where in shul they wanted to do things, they wanted to do the Shabbos of Thanksgiving. And the Rav says, no. Now, the Rav's a big believer in Thanksgiving. You celebrate Thanksgiving, but that's a secular date. You don't pick Shabbos and turn that into the Shabbos of Thanksgiving. You have to separate the two. He says, we must abstain from composing, quote, synthetic and meaningless prayers for that occasion. You know, they wanted the rabbis to come up with a special prayer on Thanksgiving, a reading or something, and the Rav is like, no way. He says, quote, let us leave this type of creativity and ingenuity to the liberal and semi-liberal rabbis. The Psalms of David are good enough for us. So you want to recite a song, Thanksgiving? Just recite one of the Tehillim. You don't come up with your own reading. He says, a combined religious service of Orthodox, Conservative, Reformed Jews is out of the question. Many of you probably think that this is extremism. Why can't we get together and have a joint prayer with our non-Orthodox brothers? You know, bringing peace to America, success, and all that. The Rav has no problem if you, Mark Shapiro, and the non-Orthodox Jew recite a prayer together. However, as an organized thing from rabbinic bodies, that can't be done because that, if you do it, as he says, as individuals, he says you can sign things, and I certainly think he would say you can pray together. That's not the problem. But as a groups, what this does is grant validity. If the Orthodox are having a prayer together with the conservative, you're giving them a certain, you're giving them a validity. You're treating them as an equal. You're not coming together just as individual Jews are coming together as rabbinic bodies, and it's very important for symbolic significance and also to show the Jewish world in America that we as Orthodox Jews do not wreck. It's not like we have Orthodox rabbis, conservative reform rabbis. No, there's only one type of rabbi. The rest, the Rav thinks, I don't want to offend anyone listening who's not part of the Orthodox or doesn't have this thing. The Rav feels that there's imposters. And you can't. Now, on a personal level, we saw with Rabbi Shubo, he refers to him as rabbi, he treats him dignified. On the other hand, in the commune, but that's as a individual. And remember, the Rav wouldn't come, even though he's very great friends with him, he wouldn't come in his rabbinic mode to come to the temple of the conservatives when they dedicated it, because that would imply an imprimatur. Private citizens, private friendships, even private prayers, fine. But as a group, absolutely not. And the implications of this for things like the New York Board of Rabbis, et cetera, are going to be clear. So we're going to have to see if there's a stira among what the Rav says here and his grudging acceptance, or at least agreement, that the Synagogue Council of America, New York Board of Rabbis, we'll get to that later. He agrees, the Rav, that we're going to have to acquiesce to a religious service on a national scale outdoors in Washington, D.C., because this committee had scheduled a big event in Washington. And the Rav says he's intelligent enough to realize that if you're having a big event with the non-Jewish dignitaries and senators and congressmen, that we have to take part of, even though the non-Orthodox are taking part of it, because we can't, such a public event, we can't just leave it for the non-Orthodox to be the spokesman of Judaism. So when it's an inner Jewish, and when this is going to play itself out again and again, we'll see the Rav statement about how we relate to non-Orthodox vis-a-vis, you know, chutz versus internally. When it's just Jews, Jewish organizations, and it's internally, we can't be involved in rabbinic mode with any of these groups. However, when it's public with the non-Jews, and it's, like he says, an outdoor event with non-Jewish dignitaries, we need to be there. He says, it is proper to participate. To our non-Jewish neighbors, we should appear united. So it's not just, I think, though, that we should appear united to the non-Jews so they don't make these divisions. I think the Rav was also concerned about the fact we can't see the public square. Can you imagine if the only spokesman for tradition, for Judaism, became the Reform and the Conservative? You know, you have this big event that the whole country's watching, and the only people there are the non-Orthodox rabbis. Then from then on, anytime anyone wants to know what Judaism says, you go to them. The Rav said, an event like that, then we have to take part in. Now, what about interfaith? They want to also have interfaith stuff on this, because the non-Jewish religions also want to take part in you know, showing their thanks that the Jews came to America. Very nice stuff. He says that his old idea, which he's repeated, he's very consistent on this. When it comes to secular activities, we're willing, ready, and willing to encourage such projects. Understand, this is a big difference from the right-wing Orthodox. The right-wing Orthodox, as far as I know, has never supported anything like that. What they will do is they'll join together with the Catholics, for instance, to lobby the governor to have vouchers for schools or things like that. But these are matters that directly affect the pocketbook or the security of the Jewish community. The Rav is not speaking about that. The Rav is speaking, and he makes it very clear in his letter to the RCA, deal with interfaith, that I already mentioned many weeks ago. We live in this world too, and matters that affect all of us. If it's, let's say, issues of pollution, and the Catholics want to organize something, it's totally appropriate, the Rav says, for us to be involved with that too. And he explains this in his letter to the RCA. However, no joint worship. We are loyal citizens of our great country, and we're committed to all its institutions, etc. So joint action and common effort are commendable in areas of mundane effort. When it comes to prayer, that, he says, it's an inner experience. It's an intimate experience. We can't share it with that. We know, and that's a very common to the Rav. He's repeated it again and again. For the Rav, at the end of the day, fundamentally, we're really one person standing before God. His whole notion is about loneliness, and we're all individual before God, but we're also a community, and he's very afraid of watering down, as all these services. You ever seen these interfaith services on TV or something? It's hard to see something Jewish about it. It's very super parv, and we don't go for parv. We have our own. Although, if you remember, this takes us back now to maybe class 2 or 3 of my latest book series. You can go back during COVID. You could see a video there of the chief rabbis of Israel having a joint prayer service of sorts, with the non-Jewish prayer leaders, each one reading. They don't read at the same times, but they go around. Each one reads a prayer and a psalm. The Rav would have a fit if he saw that. Okay, that's what can you say? Now, the same, in the following letter in the book, Rabbi Rachman also writes, at this time he's rabbi of Shari Tefillah in Far Rockaway. My wife's parents, grandparents and great-grandparents, Joe, he also writes to the Rav about this as well. And apparently he sent the Rav a service. Well, it is a service. He said, the service, quote, concocted by some rabbi of the synagogue council. You can imagine they came up on the synagogue council with some service that they sent down. And look what the Rav says. This service suggests to me both religious infantilism and Christian Methodist sentimentalism, which exhausts itself in hymn singing and responsive reading. You know, basically, it's almost like a church service. You can this rabbi came up with a service where there'd be responsive reading, all that. It's very American. But it's very American because it's very American church-like. We don't do that sort of thing. I have to tell you, by the way, in terms of responsive reading, there's one area. Art Scroll has been able to triumph in many areas. But if you pay attention to the Nusach and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, there's a number of times where Art Scroll says responsively, and yet we sing it. So Art Scroll was able to get rid of, on Hallel, Hodu. We used to also, when I was young, we all would sing it together. And really, it is supposed to be done responsively, although if I recall correctly, the Aruch HaShulchan already mentions that people don't do it responsively, and I think he's Mohammed's Chus. But now, I mentioned this many times, it's going back to responsively, and if you try to sing along Yomar Na, like you did Yomar Na Yisrael, like when you were a kid, someone will shush you, because you're supposed to be quiet and responsively. But they haven't yet got rid of the Nusach HaRosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. That, there are many, at least in my show, where I was davening, many things we sing together. We don't do it responsively. Why should you have to do it responsively? Who said? Is halacha a piyut that someone said you have to do this responsively? No. How already it's different. It's of a higher standard. But a medieval piyut team, how can anyone tell you how it's supposed to be done? So the Rav is very upset with this. In fact, he says further, he says that the service of the Methodist Church is actually superior to that advocated by the synagogue council rabbi. Because that's what they do in churches, but we don't do that in shuls. And again, he suggests Hanukkah or maybe Sukkot for the commemoration. And he says, what do we stress? The Rav now says what we need to stress on this day. The historical miracle of the rise and growth of the United States, a country which has given the world true ideals of political democracy and the dignity of the individual, ideas which are closely intertwined with the biblical philosophical anthropology. Sounds just like Tikva Society, the Tikva Fund, and Mayor Soloveitchik, and that's it, right there. The Rav speaks about how the Americanism, you know, this idea of joining Americanism and Judaism. His great nephew, Mayor Soloveitchik, is making a very fine living now, going around the country. I think he's the leading public intellectual now in the Jewish world. If not the Jewish world, certainly the Orthodox world, Mayor Soloveitchik. If you haven't heard him, Bible 365, and now he's doing something on the Siddur, and he did something in Jerusalem. He's really unique. He has a talent, but that's very much in line. But here you see the Rav, sounding just like his great nephew. Two, what do we need to stress on the tercentenary? The miracle of development of a strong and materially rich Jewish community. So America, we have to stress America, what America is. Democracy, freedom, everything that makes America great. But we also have to stress America, what America became. We have to stress Judaism in America, what Judaism became in America. Now, you can say, wait a second, what did Judaism become in America? It's a treif and a medima. People came to America and they lost their Yiddishkeit. The Rav doesn't look at it this way. The Rav sees... I mean, if you know what's going on in Europe, they've been losing it all in Europe also. He sees that... In the 50s, you can already speak about the miracle of a great community that's developed. And third, the miracle of religious freedom, which affords in particular us Orthodox Jews boundless opportunities to organize our lives. So America, the greatness of America, two, the Jewish people as a whole, what they were able to become in America, and three, that America allows Orthodox Judaism to develop, along, quote, traditional halachic lines and develop institutions of learning at all levels from the primary to the academic. Now, the Rev writes this in 54. Can you only imagine what he would have said in 2023? In fact, the Rev never would have imagined this. We have him on tape from the 50s in which the Rev says there's no Hasidus in America. He said, I saw Hasidus in Warsaw. There's nothing in America. And someone says, no, there is. And the Rev says, don't tell me I've seen real Hasidus. But the Rev was wrong. He said, and the Rev says, you can never have Hasidus in America like there was. And he's speaking in the 50s when everything was about assimilation, the melting pot. Well, the Rav was wrong. Fast forward. We do have real Hasidus. We got Satmar and Bells and Bubov in the 50s. Who would have ever imagined that you could have Kehilas, New Square, for heaven's sakes? Who could imagine you could have stuff like this? The rise of multiculturalism, what happened in the 60s and the 70s, the welfare state. There's lots of things that allowed this development. Kiryas Yoel. Al v'chomer, what the Rav spoke about, the great success that we were able for Orthodox Jews in the 50s, take a look at what it is now, three generations or so later. And then he returns, so what do we do if we're going to have an event? Let's say you want to have something in the synagogue. He says, obviously, and we need brevity and terseness. We're not Methodists, and hymn singing is not our forte. He says you can have a few appropriate psalms to be recited after the Kaddish, after Aleinu. So the Rav is, and this is going to be come back to us later when we deal with Yom HaTzmaut. You can't mess around with davening. After davening, then you can put some Tehillim in if you want. The Rav even says, I'm not against responsive reading in English of the psalms, but you have to read the Hebrew first. That's what the Rav says. What's the problem? Why can't you just read it in English? It's not the minhag of the shul. In a shul, you have to read it in the original. This goes back. It's already we dealt with the Reform movement. What was the strong opposition to prayer in the vernacular? This isn't even prayer. But it goes against the minhag of a shul. And finally, he says, as part of that day, that let's say we're going to have in shul, if we're going to have a one-day thing where we stress the tercentenary, because the Rav says we don't do 6-7 months, he says that we must emphasize the duty of each and every Jew to live in accordance with the laws of our country and exemplify all virtues of citizenry. Again, the Rav pointing out there's no conflict with Judaism and Americanism. Jews need to know that to be a good Jew, you have to be a good American. You have to exemplify all virtues of citizenry. Quote, by displaying a high sense of civic morality, the Jew sanctifies the name of God. And he says that if you have an infraction against the legal or moral code, you create a chilul Hashem. So he says that you can, a good idea, the Rav says, take sayings of Chazal that focus on Kiddush and chilul Hashem. And, okay, so that's, you get a sense here, the Rav, as he didn't like the term modern Orthodox Jew, so I won't use the term modern with capital M, but he definitely is a modern Orthodox Jew with a lower M. The idea that he's speaking about our role in society, the importance of us living, the values of citizenry, we know that in the right wing, and especially if you go into the more right wing, the Hasidic world, they want to remove themselves as much as physically possible from a wider society. If it's not creating a complete ghetto like Kiryas Yoel or Hasidic communities, it's really removing us as much as we can without creating anti-Semitism or anything like that. So you find that middle ground. The Rav is no. The Rav is positive about taking our place in this society. And that's a positive thing for Jews to show the virtues of citizenry. And we know the Rav's idea that we have to conquer everything, every pursuit, every academic pursuit, everything we can bring Torah Judaism to bear in every aspect of American society. And we don't need to run away from it. And he speaks of, we have to stress, he says, our duties as traditionally minded Orthodox Jews within the American Commonwealth, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay. So, nothing that, were surprising. In the next letter, page 119, he was asked again by Rabbi Adams. In 53, Rabbi Adams is now a rabbi in Jersey City. Jersey City, the Jewish community, Orthodox community ended, but I think now it's come back. I don't just mean now the Satmar. The Satmar have started in Jersey City. In fact, there was a terrorist attack in Jersey City a few years ago. But I think there's even a modern, or not, I don't know, I think a modern Orthodox shul, correct me if I'm wrong, that also opened up in Jersey City. It makes sense. It's close to New York. So, but he was rabbi in Jersey City then, and this is not long after the Holocaust. So the question to the Rav was, can you have memorial prayers for the Holocaust in the Seder? We know that at the Seder, people like to add things in. During Soviet Jewry, the time of Soviet Jewry, there'd be something that people would add for Soviet Jewry. There's all these things people like to add. So the Rav was asked about that. And before he was asked about it, he was also... Rabbi Adams had sent him a responsum from a conservative rabbi about grafting human bone tissue. I tried to find it. You have to look in the Rabbinical Assembly volumes, the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards. You'd find it, but I couldn't find it because I don't have access to it all. But the Rav says, I have not read the responsum you sent me on the question of grafting human bone tissue. I tore it up immediately. I refuse to deal with any halachic essay, regardless of the scholastic merits or fallacies prepared by a representative of a group whose philosophy is diametrically opposed to Torah and tradition, and which does not accept the authority of halacha as divine and transcendental guide for the individual and the community. So it's the Rav. Rabbi Adam sent him what he thought was an interesting response. The Rav's opinion, the Rav won't even read it, because I'm not going to even look at the writings of someone who doesn't accept Torah in its entirety. We know that for a halachic decision to be valid, it isn't just enough to have an argument and to make sense and to cite the sources. That's obviously important, but you also need the imprimatur of the writer. The writer needs to have a status of authority himself, or herself, maybe today, and therefore you need both of them. So if the writer, if the author of it, is not a faithful adherent to Torah Judaism, the fact that he come up with great proofs and everything are irrelevant. Now, the Rav is a little bit extreme on this. Others have a different approach. Their attitude is that we can look at the arguments, and if the arguments are good, we can use the arguments, not because this person said it, just because they're good arguments. We have Gedolei Yisrael who looked at the Besamim Rosh, that forged volume of Tshuva we spoke about in the Reform classes from Shaul Berlin, and they cite the Besamim Rosh, not because the Besamim Rosh has any authority, but the argument's a good argument. And if the argument's a good argument, you can use it. But the Rav is more extreme. He won't even look at it. Okay, so then what to do about the night of the Seder? The Rav is not happy. He doesn't think that anything should be added to the Seder service in memory of people in the Holocaust. He says that we have separate prayers. We have Yisker prayers. We say it on the pilgrimage festivals and the Yom Kippur, and we have Av HaRachamim. We can add something in those prayers. But we don't take a service like the Seder, which is devoted to Yetzias Mitzrayim, and add something in. There is no reason why we should add a new memorial for the martyrs of the most recent catastrophe as part of the Seder service, which has been dedicated to the great miracle of Jewish redemption and survival. He says that the experience of Jewish martyrdom finds its expression in other areas, other prayers, not with the Exodus. He goes on to say that the people from the Bar Kokhba or the Crusades or the Spanish Inquisition or the Cossack pogroms, they didn't find it necessary to stick something into the Seder about this. The Halacha, he says, always looks askance upon any attempt to introduce a note of sadness into the joyous mood of the festival. Passover night, we're supposed to be happy. It's about joy. How could you put something in that brings a mention of the Holocaust? And this goes back, I mean, these are all, I think, reasons the Rav is giving for it. But fundamentally, the Rav's position is that we don't alter the prayers that have been handed down. And we're going to see this again, Yom HaTzmaot. We don't change it. Even Nachem, Tisha B'Av, read the Nachem. Ask yourself if you can say this prayer. Is Jerusalem a desolate city? The Rav says we don't change prayers, we don't have the authority, and certainly the Seder, which is such an important event, you're going to start messing around with the Seder, putting in a memorial prayer in the Seder. There's a lot of other times to put a memorial prayer. The Rav sees this as just artificial and against the whole ethos of the service. He says, instead, ask all the shuls to say them Kel Malei Rachamim for the millions of martyrs on the last day of Pesach. You can include this in Yisker services, but we don't mess around with the prayers. Okay, we have a few more minutes. The next letter, we're going quickly on these, deals with, quote, a proposed service authored by the Mizrahi for the eve of Yom HaTzmaut. This is going to get us into something very controversial because the Rav, or something, I shouldn't say controversial, something where the Rav really was at odds with American Orthodoxy. And I think it's correct to say if the Rav in the 50s had the stature of the Rav today, American Orthodoxy would be very different. I mean, the prayer we say in pretty much all the shuls, the modern Orthodox shuls, the Rav didn't agree with this. But American Orthodoxy was not looking to the Rav as deciding their liturgy in the 50s. They were very excited about the state, the chief rabbinate, all these things. The Rav is going to be very much at odds with the tenor, I think, of most of modern Orthodox Jewry, although it could be changing. So, for instance, I know a shul, I know it well, that they refuse to say challah on Yom HaTzmaut, and some people are very upset. And the rabbi says, well, this is a lawyer person, that this is the Rav's position. You don't, in the middle of davening, you want to do something after davening, you can, but not in the middle of davening. Definitely not with a bracha. Okay, so what's the Mizrahi came out with a prayer service. There's more than one, but already in the 50s they did, not just for the day of Yom HaTzmaut, for the evening of Yom HaTzmaut. This is something that I don't know how popular it is. When I lived in the Upper West Side, at the Jewish Center, they actually did this, the eve of Yom Ha'atzmaut, a whole prayer service, maybe in Canada. Canada is very, is more tzioni, I think, than here, where you do something, not just get together, but maybe have a speaker, but actual, a separate text of davening. And for a long time, I didn't even know what this text was, but one of the Koran Siddurim I saw had this text. It's a whole prayer service. And in fact, it even includes saying of Hallel in the evening. Originally, the chief rabbinate ruled Hallel without a bracha. When Rav Gurin came in, it was with a bracha. So the discussions we're going to see are Hallel without a bracha. So Rabbi Adams sent the Rav, this the prayer service prepared from the Mizrahi in Israel for the evening of Yom Ha'atzma'ut. And the question was, should we send this out to all members of the RCA? Because we're all Mizrahi people, and this is a, this, we should do this. We all love the Israel. And the Rav replies, first of all, he said the service was arranged in a non-halachic and non-scholarly fashion and breathes meaningless ceremonialism, which is not only alien, but also contrary to our halachic tradition. If it's new, if it's something that we didn't receive by Masorah from the previous generations, as far as the Rav is concerned, it's meaningless ceremonialism. It, the fact that it could be great rabbis who put this together, later I'll read you what the Rav has to say about what happened at YU when a group of students went against the Rav's wishes and actually instituted this Mizrahi service during the daytime. And the Rav went crazy at a shiur, and we have the whole audio tape of what he had to say. I don't think the Rav would have said this if it wasn't off the cuff. But for the Rav, this is meaningless ceremonialism. And when it comes to Hallel in the evening, I don't know if Rabbi Kelmi, do they do Hallel in Canada in the evening? You can tell us if they do. The Rav says
a partial hello, if you want. We'll talk about
hollow.
It. Out.
Okay. The Rav says that this is in opposition to the halachic truism that the recital of Hallel only belongs to the day, except for Hallel on Pesach, and that has a separate reason because it's an integral part of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. He says if these people want to institute the saying of Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut, because they think the great miracle of the state of Israel warrants it, then at least they should do it in accord with halacha. And if they just want to recite psalms, you know, they're just going to take the psalms and say, well, we're just reciting the psalms of Hallel. He says, well, why the psalms of Hallel? There's lots of psalms that you can recite. Not to mention the fact that Rav says you're not supposed to recite psalms in the evening before midnight. At least he says there's a Jewish custom. You know, I think he just throws that in parentheses because this custom is really honored in the breach. How many people know that, I think it's even a Kabbalistic thing, that you're not supposed to do Tehillim at night. You're not supposed to do Tanakh, Nach, at all at night. There's this whole tradition not doing it. But today, I think we'd be happy if anyone is learning at night. You tell someone who's learning Nach at night, you're not supposed to learn Nach at night. Then just, and that's never been accepted by everyone. It's a minhag. And then the Rav says, and we'll get into more detail later when the Rav explains why he's so opposed to all the changes of Yom Ha'atzmaut. And the Rav lost this battle because the standard modern Orthodox shul either recites Hallel with a bracha or at least without a bracha, and they don't recite it at the end of davening like the Rav's compromise was. They recite it during davening at Shemona Esrei. At least that's been my experience. And it's not that the Rav is not a Zionist. The Rav is a Zionist. But the Rav is going to be very firm that just because you're a Zionist doesn't mean you play around with the text of the prayers. We'll have to get into that in more detail. But the Rav concludes, leaving aside the issues of how he thinks that the Mizrahi messed it all up with how they, you know, with the Hallel and the night and everything else they said, he thinks that the RCA shouldn't be disseminating materials that doesn't come from us. We're our own organization. We decide what to do. We don't take, we don't disseminate from other people. He says, if the RCA wants to request its members to mark the 5th of Iyar by a special service, well, we should make our own service. But it'll be in a service that will be in line with scholarship and historic meaningfulness. He says, this might, if you're a real Zionist, you might be upset with this and you might, with the Rav. He says, in my opinion, this is how he ends the letter, and we'll end with this. All the RCA has to do is to ask the rabbis to interpret in their sermons the birth of the Jewish state in terms of our religious philosophy of history and warn against any attempt of secularization of Jewish life. So what the Rav says, you want to recognize the state of Israel, the anniversary, the rabbi should give a sermon speaking about how important the Jewish state is. No special prayers, no special tefillahs, none of that stuff. So we will return to that later. In fact, in the book, Alf got, I don't even know if he has more on this. If not, I'll have to tell you what appears in the Rav Thinking Aloud, because he skips. No, we'll get to it later, because the Rav deals with religious Zionism. And I'll deal with it then. Or maybe even next class I'll deal with it. But so we'll skip the next series of letters we've already done. These all deal with prayers in synagogues with mixed pews. So we know the Rav's position on that. And when we come back next time, we'll pick up very important interview the Rav gave, which really set the modern Orthodox approach on how we're supposed to relate to non-Orthodox groups. Then the Rav will deal with Synagogue Council of America, because the approach of the Rav, the approach of the OU, is at odds with the approach of the Aguda. Very much so. And we'll see the Rav's way, and the Rav is going to follow in his, follow the Netziv, follow. He has a good tradition to follow in. But it's already time, so let me end here. And next class, I think I'll talk about his talk to the Smicha students about Yom HaTzmaut. Okay, Rabbi Kalman, you want to say it quickly or first or no?
No, I mean, you can go through all the questions. I was just saying.
Okay,
I
so go through all the questions and you'll be at the end. Yeah, okay, so let me quickly. We don't have as many questions. iPad says, Jewish law versus secular, theory versus practice, many more systems of secular law, many try to improve it. Yeah, you mentioned Eliezer Berkovitz, but his approach was rejected. But there have been, we just mentioned the RCA. The RCA came up with a prenuptial agreement, which accomplishes what Rabbi Berkovitz's proposal was. So there have been changes, and there's other areas that there could be movement. I was speaking about even in terms of a dayan. A dayanim, they can issue pshara, they can do things. In other words, you don't have to assume that the law as it is the ultimate. Sometimes there could be alternate versions. Maybe we can't do it yet. Maybe when a Sanhedrin will come, it'll change it. That's okay to say that also. I think it's totally okay to say that, you know, yes, this is a bit of a problem, but we don't have the authority to change it. But if a Sanhedrin comes, they can make some changes. I think that's an honest way. Rabbi Weinberg said that. Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg said, he said about, he gave a psak, and he said that this psak causes me pain. He says, I wish the halacha was differently. He says, Isser ze gorem litzar gadol. He says, but what can I do? This is what the Shulchan Aruch says. He wishes that he had the authority to overrule the Shulchan Aruch. Maybe a greater posek could. But
Rabbi,
yeah. Yes.
Even you know that, you know more cases than I would. If you belong to one community, Ger or whatever, and you have a dispute with somebody from a different community, both guys don't trust the other's law courts for this stuff in many cases, because they feel they're at a home field disadvantage. So the law on the ground between one group of Hasidim and another is such that they don't trust each other, and that's a huge failing as well.
Obviously, it's a failing, and they should be able to do Zebor. Really, they should be able to each one pick a Dayan from one their side, and then the two Dayan can pick another one. But if they don't trust their courts, then they can go to the RCA based, or they can go to Gudas Rabbonim based. But it is a big Chil Hashem that there have been some important cases where Hasidim have gone to secular courts, and it's a problem. Rabbi Kalman says the Drisha, the Bina Choshe Mishpat, says that the expression that one who is donned in emes le'amito, truth to truth, becomes a partner with God, means to rule lefi ha'mokom lefi ha'zman, according to the time and place. Yeah, so, exactly. Sometimes if you rule according to the written law without dealing with equity, you come up with a bad decision, a bad ruling. someone privately says that stories like the Beis Halevi and his divorce turn people off to Judaism because it's ridiculous. How can you treat anyone like that? No one's here to defend the father-in-law of the Beis Halevi, but it's a true story. It happened. Maybe it was a little more complicated. Maybe he didn't like the Beis Halevi to begin with, and he just uses it as an excuse. But obviously, it's a crazy thing. The Beis Halevi. You think that this father-in-law, he should be jumping for joy that that's who his son-in-law is, the Beis Halevi? Maybe years later, when he saw that he ended up with a grandchild who became totally irreligious, and look who the Beis Halevi's, look who his grandson would have been if he Beis Halevi remained his son-in-law. Let's hope that he regretted his rash action. By the way, when the story's told, it's always told how stupid this guy is. But it's also told as an example that when you become a rabbi, you could be a big, big Talmud Chacham. You could have been in Kovel for a number of years. You still have to make sure you know what the Ruach says, because it's going to be a little embarrassing to you if you don't know that on this day, we don't say Avarachamim on this day or something like that. What I was told by one rabbi in the field is that when you make this mistake, if you want to spare yourself the embarrassment, because every rabbi makes the mistake when you're running a shul, until you run a minyan. I ran a minyan for 3 years. You don't realize these cases that come up, these things you never could have imagined. Like, what are you supposed to do now? You forget. Are you supposed to do this first or say that first? You always forget. But if you're caught and it's embarrassing, I was told by a rabbi who remained nameless, because some people might, I think it's funny, but you might not think it's funny. He said, just tell them it's minhag agrah. If ever something is strange, you can say you do it. And he says, no, it's supposed to be done that way. So, oh, okay. Well, that's minhag the gra, but we'll do this way because that's what everyone else does. So, the gra often does things differently. So, I'm not sure whether he meant it seriously or half jokingly, but it'll get you out of any, problem. And Rabbi, Yellen, who wrote an entire book dealing with, that would touch on issues like this. He says that part of what Rabbi Kelman stated above, Donim et Lomito, becomes a partner of God, is mentioned Shabbos 10a, and he cites his book, A Code of Conduct for Business Consistent with Jewish Law and Tradition. And of course, in that book, Rabbi Yellen will point out how you can have this conflict between equity and the letter of the law. And this is something that they're always, all the Rabbanim have been cognizant of. And if the law permits, we try to move in the direction of equity, of yosher. That's why when the parties agree to pshara, the dayanim can move in that direction. That's a good way to finish up. Mel says, Arov. Rav Sufkin said it was insects. What do we usually translate Arov as? Animals, right?
Wild beasts.
Wild beasts, yes. I think that's what it is. New JPS has. Justin says 1623. Hold on, the ladder is sharing. 1623, the Jews came from Holland. So why were they? So it's not really tercentenary in 1553. It's I guess they're maybe saying from the time they opened the synagogue, the first synagogue. It's the 300th anniversary of when they opened the synagogue. Thank you very much, Justin. Yes, who was talking?
I just wanted to, there are dozens of opinion about Arov in particular, including one that Arya Kaplan mentions that cracks me up. He thinks it's a giant, cites a measure, it's a giant squid.
Squid in Egypt?
Okay. But for something like that, there is no agreement. You can find somebody who says anything. There'll be somebody out there has the opinion.
Ibn Ezra says that Sardea is crocodiles. Rabbi Shunah says Harry Friedman published his own beautiful chumashim, similar to the
riff, Iran, Abravanel, and what's important is Malbim takes Abravanel on and says, because Abravanel's reasoning is that a maka has got to be lethal, not just a nuisance. You cannot overstate Abravanel's influence on Malbim, and Malbim tears into him. Cites about half a dozen examples where maka means a nuisance, not lethal. You can find opinions on that for everything. Menachem Leibtag speaks about this.
So thank you for that. But I mean, I just happened to remember JPS. But that's not what the Rav is referring to. The Rav is referring to something where, like, when it says that the slave he remains forever, we know that the Tarsha Baal Peh just needs to know that. So those are the sorts of things he was talking about. Rabbi Shunah points out, I didn't know this, that Rabbi Friedman published his own Chumash, which is like the Hertz. I have to check that out. I'm going to make a note of that to order from Interlibrary Loan to see that, because I have, ne to my knowledge, I've never seen that Chumash.
Yeah, I saw it at Central Synagogue in Bondi in Sydney. But when I went into Gold's, into the store to purchase it, they would not have it out to be seen and readily available, but quietly they would go into the back and they would bring out a
I'm going to
and
ask
sell it.
my friend is the rabbi of Central Synagogue now, Rabbi Ben Elton in Sydney. So I will ask him about that. Hopefully he can get it for me. Marty. Yeah.
Ben Elton is at Great Synagogue, Sydney.
Great synagogue, not
Not
central.
the
Right,
same.
great.
Not the same. Yeah,
Yes, thank you. You have spent, I've never been, and I was supposed to go, but I had to
He's
cancel
a
my trip in February.
lovely, lovely guy.
Yeah.
I love him. Beautiful.
Okay.
Beautiful.
Marty said, would joint services be prohibited if there are no violations of halacha? The joint service is prohibited precisely because it's prohibited for an Orthodox rabbi to do a service with a conservative or a reform rabbi because that gives them legitimacy, validity. Are you going to find that anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch and any siman? No, you won't find it, but the Rav would say that this is like underlays the basis of what tefillah is, what halacha is. Now you point out interestingly that in Mamaroneck, Chabad and the Conservative Synagogue held a joint tashlich service. I don't know. Tashlich is not. I don't know. The Rav will probably oppose that also. I mean, unless you want to make a case that tashlich is not. Did they read the tashlich together? Did they just walk together to the lake? If they just walk together to the lake and everyone says it privately, it's one thing. But if the rabbi, both rabbis, the Chabad and the Orthodox rabbi, read it responsively together, the Rav would say absolutely usur, forbidden. Ellen says Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur liturgy has responsive reading because people didn't know it. That's a good answer. Let me just go through quickly. Yes, Rabbi Kellen points out Rav Aaron disagreed with the Rav Rei Nachem regarding Nachem, but did he agree with him in practice or just in theory?
I don't know for sure, but what I was told is what Aaron said, you cannot say the Nachem. How can you say that? It's a lack of Hakar Satov for all the wonderful miracles we have. There are hundreds of thousands of Jews living in Shom. It's not an Ir Bezuya Belibaneha, and you can't say it. I did not hear this with my own ears, so but I heard it from people who learned in the Gush from Avara. So I don't know. You can check it.
Yeah. There's
Yeah.
a yeah.
With non-Orthodox people going to non-Orthodox schools, all that. That's more. I don't know that the Rav, I don't know that the, when the Rav said don't go to a non-Orthodox shul, he wasn't talking to conservative Jews. He's talking to an
No,
Orthodox.
he wasn't talking to them. He wasn't talking to them. He was talking to Orthodox Jews who might go to a non-Orthodox. So we spoke about that at length. Rabbi Ellen points out that Beth Jacob in Beverly Hills has an evening Yom Ha'atzmaut tefillah. The question is, do they have challah, though? If they just have tefillah and have a chazan, do they mess around with the matzbeah of tefillah by including challah? They definitely do in other shuls. I've seen it. And Rabbi Kelman says that the main evening event has 1,500 people with parts of Kabbalah Shabbos using Nusach of Yom Tov. Like the Rav had a real problem with this. He couldn't handle it. And finally, Dov says that he heard from the Rav. That Rabbi Dov, that our custom of responsive reading is modeled after the form of prayer of Melachim, Mechulam, Mekubalim, Vnosnim, Okay. The thing is that, you have all these prayers that the Machzor says responsive. Art Scroll, I think all this means is that in Europe they read it responsively, so then Art Scroll decides, that this should be responsively, but it's not like. There's no one that says you have to read it responsively. If you go to Yeshiva Shminyanim, they do a Lecha Dodi responsively. It's like a halacha. So you have to do it quietly and you have to do it. Now, Lecha Dodi from, it's the last prayer to be added to the liturgy, a few hundred years old. Like, if we want to do it responsibly, who says we can't? If we want to do it all, sing it all together. Why can't we sing it all together? What's the halacha that says we can't if we like singing it all together? So I think we need to distinguish between things like in Hallel, which already we have a reason for being responsively, I think the other prayers, whatever works for the community. If you want to sing the whole thing together, why not? It's okay, Rabbi Kelman, wait, if there's anything else. If not, thank you all for coming out on a nice Yom Tov evening with no rain.
No rain here. Yes, yes. Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll see you next week on Ishchag. And Monday night, tomorrow, Dr. Sokolow finishes up his series on the Haftarot of Tishrei. And then Rabbi Shulman continues his class on Kohelet. He asked me, "You're having class on Kohelet?" I said, "Next week." I said, "Well, can we not have a class on Kohelet?" And on Shemini Atzeret, this is the most important week of the class on Kohelet. So that'll be tomorrow, a doubleheader, 10 and 1. Then Thursday, Chazan Malavani on Tfilat Geshem, Rivka Press Schwartz on Vizor HaBracha. Friday morning, I'll be speaking. I'll probably be either 9:30 or 9:45. I haven't quite figured out which dominion I'm going to Devon's with. We will have the shiur on Friday. I'll post the act time, be a few minutes later than normal, but hopefully not too much. Okay, and we look forward to learning with you, and hopefully in the next couple of days we'll download our fall schedule, and everybody have a Chag Sameach, Modim L'Simcha, enjoy. Okay.
Thank you.
Modim L'Simcha.
Chagim Osmanim L'Sason.
There we go. I was waiting for that. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, love it. Bye. Yeah, thank you.